Okay, tonight I want to pick up where we left off in the Psalms. We left off in the Psalm 139. And this is quite a psalm. It's only 24 verses, but man, it really, really goes deep in terms of, God's, his omnipresence. In other words, he's just everywhere. You can't escape from his spirit. He's everywhere you can possibly imagine. And also his omniscience. In other words, he's all-knowing. He knows everything. He knows it before it's going to happen. He knows our thoughts from afar. That's something that's so hard for any of us to wrap our minds around, that God could be, that almighty, that all-powerful. I mean, just look at the size of this universe, and his spirit fills the whole thing. And, if he were to withdraw his spirit, all life would perish. Everything's open to him. It doesn't matter. Death, hell, heaven, earth, it doesn't matter. Every stray atom in his universe, he has complete knowledge and control of. Even Jesus Christ said that not a sparrow falls to the ground or falls from the sky without him knowing it. It's just that kind of knowledge. It just boggles your mind, staggers your imagination. It almost seems like to us, even though we consider it, that God, has that kind of power, we just can't understand that. I can't. Like I said, just look out there in the heavens. Just look at the 8 billion people on this planet, and the billions of others that came before them, and how many are going to come in the future. And he knows everyone's thoughts. I'd get a migraine just trying to keep track of one person. it really, really does boil down to the man. This God is just beyond our ability to comprehend. I wouldn't say to comprehend. We most certainly, he has revealed himself through Jesus Christ and through his word and through his prophets in such a way that we can understand, what we need to know in terms of him. But I tell you what, this God is just absolutely infinite in every way. And it also, I think, really emphasizes the fact that we are created in God's image and likeness. And he puts eternal value upon every soul. And that's something I think we've really lost sight of today. But anyway, let's just go ahead and begin with this verse 1 of Psalm 139. When David writes, he says this, "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down and are intimately acquainted with all of my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it." Isn't that just what I was talking about? "Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol," now Sheol could refer to the bed, or could refer to the hell or the grave, but I think he's talking about, both in this context. "If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb, and I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. How precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I'm still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. For they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the uttermost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way." Like I said, this is only 24 verses, but I tell you, I mean, you could literally write books and books on this one chapter. I mean, it just really, really goes deep. The height and the breadth and the width of this and the length of it, it really is infinite, because God is infinite and He's synonymous with His Word. But just going back to this verse 1 of Psalm 139, it says, O Lord, You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, and You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path by lying down and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, You know it all. Now, here's the thing. I don't know. There's been so many fools throughout the ages who say things like, well, God is dead. I mean, like Nietzsche came across and said, well, you know, God just wound up this entire universe like a big clock, and then He went off and died somewhere. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. But I tell you what, you know, this God is very is very much alive and well. And, you know, when you just read this, the first four verses here, He is intimately acquainted with each and every one of us and all of our ways and all of our thoughts and what we do, what we don't do, what our motives are. I mean, it is really, really vast, His understanding, His knowledge. It's infinite. He says, Oh Lord, You have searched me and know me. Now, here's the thing. I don't think that people should look at this and say, well, you know, God is just there to just scrutinize our every little move, everything that we think, everything that we say. Here in that verse 3, You scrutinize my path and my lying down. Well, what does it mean to scrutinize?
To examine very closely.
Yeah, very carefully, in detail, investigate, and, you know, almost like to put it under a microscope or to search out or, you know, to penetrate. But here's the thing. I don't think that this is any way, shape, or form suggesting that God is just looking for something to find fault with. You know what I mean? And scrutinizing our every little move and our every little thought and our everything that we possibly do. But it's all laid bare to Him. I mean, you know, we are told in Samuel that man judges the outward appearance, but God judges the heart. And that's the thing about God. I mean, He will just look into a person's, you know, He will just gaze into their soul. And He sees it all in an instant. He just knows it all in an instant. And it's not that He's out there to try to find some kind of fault, because He doesn't have to look very hard, does He? Yeah. But it does emphasize the fact that, you know what, God's not indifferent. He's not indifferent to what we think and what we do and how we act and what we don't do. He's not indifferent to that at all. I mean, He's very, very long-suffering. He's merciful and He's patient and He's kind and He's understanding. And He understands our frame. He just realizes, you know, that we are just dust and we've got fallen natures. And so He's not out there just looking for an opportunity to just squish somebody like a bug if they get out of line. But I tell you what. This is something that I really think that if people could really, really understand this, it could make a vast difference in the way they live their lives. Because we are told over and over again that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So in essence, what does that mean?
The fear of the Lord?
Yes, what does it mean in essence?
To understand that you're accountable to Him and He's going to judge everything.
Yes. See, that's the thing. If we could get that straight in our mind, you know, foremost in our mind, is, you know what? God is watching me and He's not indifferent to what I do and what I don't do. And I'm going to have to stand before Him someday and give an account for my life. You know, therefore, it should really be a prime motivator in our life to goad us in the right direction. It really should, right? Because that's why it's saying the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And I've said it many times. If you go into a store, into a, you know, a place of business, and you just feel like stuffing your pockets full of stuff and getting your five-finger discount and running out the door without paying for it, well, if you really fear God, if you go in there and even if you're tempted to take something without paying for it, in the back of your mind you say, you know what, I could get away with this easy. This is easy money. This is easy pickings. But God's watching me. And I'm going to have to count it for this. So I'm not going to do that. See, that's fear of the Lord. It really is. Now, how much fear of God do you see today around the world and in our country, in our society? I mean, there's, you know, it's a sad thing. I mean, there's virtually no fear of God in so many places and so many people and so many societies and nations and cultures. I mean, let's just look at identity theft. You know, there's identity theft going on every 2 seconds. Is that scary? But all these people who are perpetrating this kind of theft and just ruining people's lives, just destroying their lives with this kind of wickedness, do you think for 1 minute they have any fear of God? But here we are told very clearly, Jesus Christ said that even every idle word that men shall speak, they shall render an account thereof in a day of judgment. And we are told in Romans, and we are told in Corinthians, Paul says this, we shall all stand before the judgment seat of God. We're all going to stand before Him. Right? And now, is that a scary thought? And what it should really do is goad us in the right direction. That's what fear of God is. As a matter of fact, when Solomon, he's talking about God's word, he said this, and we have to understand that we're here today and we're gone tomorrow. And in the book of Ecclesiastes, he says this, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you will say, I have no delight in them. Now, tell me what that means. When it says here, remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and you no longer have any delight in them. What does that mean?
It's easy, when you're an adult, it's easy to get caught up in worry and just the worries of the world.
Well, what it's talking about, remember God when you are young. He says, because the days are coming, they're coming, and they're coming at lightning speed, believe me, when you're going to slowly begin to have no delight in your life. I've been in and out of old folks' homes, retirement homes, and convalescent homes. I've been in and out of hospitals, and I tell you what, it's a sad thing when you see people where they get to a point where they have really nothing to look forward to before the evil days come, because it goes on and says this in Ecclesiastes. It says, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain. When he says this, before the sun and the moon and the light of the stars are darkened, in other words, when you grow old, more and more, there's nothing to look forward to. There's no silver lining in anything. All right. When you say, when the clouds return after the rain, what does that mean?
No sunshine.
Yeah, no sunshine. I mean, it pours rain and then the clouds come again. And say, oh man, there's nothing to look forward to. I mean, when you get up there in age, I mean, you know, how many 90-year-old people do you know that say, oh, I can hardly wait till next week's ski trip. Just throw it out there. I mean, it's more and more, the older you get, the less you begin to enjoy your life. So he's saying, remember your Creator before these days come. And he says this, that the light of the sun and the moon are darkened. Meaning, you know what? Your eyesight slowly begins to fade. And back in Solomon's day, they didn't have, optometrists. And they didn't have glasses and contacts and LASIK surgery, this type of thing. I mean, people just went blind. He goes on to say this, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble. Anybody's Bible say the keepers of the house?
What verse?
I'm over here in Ecclesiastes 12, verse 3. Sorry about that. Okay. All right. It says here, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble. The watchmen, if you have a King James Bible, it says the keepers of the house. Now, what are the, first of all, what's the house? What's the house?
Body.
It's our body, all right? He's speaking metaphorically. This is really powerful and really rich in symbolism. He's talking about our bodies, and he's saying this, that in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble, the watchmen of the house, the keepers of the house, are our hands, all right? It's with our hands. Men use their hands to do what? To comb their hair, to wash their face, to shave their beards or whatever, and women use it to put on their war makeup and all the other things that they do with their hands. It says it says here, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and the mighty men stoop. What are the mighty men?
There are legs.
They're the mighty men, all right? And I tell you what, I've dealt with so many old people, you know, they're coming into stores on buses, and they've got marked carts, they got wheelchairs, they've got walkers, they've got canes, or they're just shuffling along because their mighty men are no longer mighty. You know, they can't go out there and, run a 100-yard dash anymore, right? I mean, their legs are giving out on them. And he says here, and the grinding ones stand idle because there are few. What are the grinding ones?
It's our teeth.
Back in Solomon's day, they didn't have what? A dentist or orthodontics. They didn't have dentures or false teeth, that type of thing. So the grinding ones are your teeth. And, you know, and your teeth fall out. There's no replacing them back in Solomon's day. And he says that the grinding ones stand idle because they are few. And those who look through windows grow dim. In other words, you know, the older you get, the more you need corrective lenses. And back in Solomon's day, people, if they came down with cataracts or whatever, they just went blind. And verse 4 in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, it says, and the doors of the street are shut, and the sound of the grinding mill is low. In other words, the doors of the street. What are the doors of the street?
Social life?
Well, yes, because...
The door.
Well, the door of your house is what?
Your mouth.
Okay, so you don't see a lot of old people who have a lot of energy to do a lot of talking, all right? And, you know, I mean, some people just go on and on and on and say nothing, but, you know, most people, they just don't have much to say, right? He says, and the doors of the street are shut, and the sound of the grinding mill is low. What does that mean?
They can't hear.
They're losing their hearing because the older you get, the more your body, this house, this tent begins to fall apart. And he says, and one will arise at the sound of a bird, meaning what?
Wake up really early.
Yes. Old people, they go to bed early because they're out of energy, but then they get up at the crack of dawn, you know, at the sound of a bird, right? And he says this, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. What does that mean? Well, when a woman is young and in her prime, I mean, a lot of these women could really have melodious voices. They could sing in operas and in choirs, and you know, they just really can, you know, belt out a tune. Well, now they can hardly even project their voices when they get older and older and older. And it says this, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and terrors on the road. Now, what does that mean? Well, when the older you get, I mean, you don't see a lot of senior citizens becoming daredevils, do you? It says, furthermore, men are afraid of a high place and tares on the road, and the almond tree blossoms, meaning what? The almond tree is the first tree to blossom in the spring, and what does it look like?
Gray.
It's all white. All white. So, you know, the older you get, the whiter your hair becomes. If it doesn't fall out altogether, he says, and the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along. What does that mean?
In the spring of yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said, you see all these old people coming in off buses and they all got walkers and canes and they're moving. They're dragging themselves along and we're all getting there at lightning speed. That's why he says, remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's why we need to fear God, I'm telling you. And he says this, and the caper bearer is ineffective. What does that mean? The caper bearer was an aphrodisiac that they would take back then to increase their sexual performance or desire and their function. Well, the older you get, the more your sexual desire or function begins to wane. And it says here, for man goes to his eternal home while the mourners go about in the street, meaning what?
Read it again.
That latter part of verse 5 in Ecclesiastes 12, it says, for man goes to his eternal home while mourners go about in the street.
He died.
Yes, and then it says, and mourners go about in the street. What does that mean?
They carry on with their lives.
Yes, exactly, exactly. In other words, you know, I mean, I don't know how many people I've buried in my lifetime, but, you know, a lot of times I would just go driving down Highway 80, and my mother's buried there, my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, my sister-in-laws, my, you know, my friends, relatives, and a lot of times I just drive by without thinking about it. Just passing their grave without thinking about it. Because why? The mourners go about in the street, but the deceased person goes to his eternal home. And it's either going to be heaven or it's going to be hell. And that's why he says in verse 6, remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. What's a silver cord?
Your spine?
It's your spinal cord. It's your nervous system. And you see the older people, a lot of times, their nervous system isn't functioning and firing the way it used to. And a lot of times you see them suffering from Parkinson's disease or the shakes or, you know, they just don't have the quickness and the agility and the speed, everything like that. The silver cord is broken. But it also says, and the golden bowl was crushed. What's the golden bowl?
Brain.
It's your brain, it's your mind. And a week and a half ago, I went to a funeral of a guy that I've known for many, many years, and he was really a sharp guy. He was such a really hard worker. And about 10 years ago, he came down with Alzheimer's. Slowly, 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 he began to just lose all remembrance of who people were. And then when I went to the funeral, and one of his sons got up and was talking about him, he said that his dad had got to the point where not only did he not know how to screw in a light bulb, but he didn't even know what a light bulb was. That is really, really sad. Now, is that sad? Because he said, remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed, the pitcher by the well was shattered and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. What does that mean, the pitcher by the well and the wheel by the cistern is crushed? What does it mean? Well, the picture by the well is your heart. That's what it's talking about. And he says here, and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. In other words, it's our heart. It's our circulatory system. It's this incredible network of what? Arteries and veins and capillaries. I mean, how many people end up dying of heart attacks, right? And he says this, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And we're just going to be reading about this in Psalm 139 in regards to dust. And returning to dust, he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now it says it will return to the earth as it was. Interesting thing. He says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was. Now, exactly what is he referring to? Exactly what does that mean?
Came from dust.
Yes, we came from dust. As a matter of fact, that the curse that was put upon Adam and Eve, God said to Adam, because he sinned against the Lord, he says, cursed is the ground because of you, and toil you will eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles. It shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. Now listen to this, by the sweat of your face you will eat bread, till you return to the ground, or turn to dust, because from it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return. God created Adam out of the dust of the ground. He says, and it's interesting, some of these Orthodox denominations, like the Catholics and the Lutherans and the Orthodox Greek and a number of others, they have what they call Ash Wednesday. You know, that's the beginning of Lent. And if you go into there on Ash Wednesday, you will go up and they put ashes on your forehead, in this, making the sign of the cross. And they will say, remember, man, that thou art dust, and from dust thou art, to dust thou shalt return. Right? I mean, this is what we're dealing with here. And then he says this, that then dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, we're going to be dealing with that in Psalm 139. The spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, when God created Adam from the dust of the ground, he was deader than a doornail till when? Until he breathed in him the breath of life, until he became a living soul, a living spirit, right? But when we die, our spirit's going to return to God who gave it. And that's where we're going to have to stand before Christ, all right, and give an account of our life. And he says, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. So what does that mean when he's tying this all together?
This is all disappearing. We're going to be it.
Well, what's vanity?
Emptiness.
It's emptiness. It's void of meaning, of purpose, you know, all this type of thing. Go to any grocery store. Next time you're in a line waiting for your, you know, to be checked out, just check out all the magazines. Just check them all out there displayed. You will see one beautiful person after another, after another, after another. I don't care whether they're actresses or models or actors or athletes. Just go down the line. You know, these glamour magazines, these self, whatever they are. And when I see them, I think to myself, well, what are they going to look like 50 years, 60 years from now? Why? Because we're all falling apart, man. This is what he's dealing with. So, if we don't have God in the equation, and I don't mean as an afterthought, I mean as a prime thought, a prime mover in our life. In other words, if God is not central, if he's not the focus of our undivided attention in this life, guess what? Everything we do in life, doesn't matter how famous and how rich and how popular and how well-known and how influential, I don't care, just throw out a person, I don't care, the greatest athlete, the greatest actor, the greatest actress, the greatest politician, the greatest world leader, just throw it out there. If God is not in their life, then everything they accomplish in this life is vanity of vanities. But now, if God is the central in our life, then our life has meaning and it has purpose and it has direction, right? Because without God, it was Peter who says that as Christians, we are living stones that are being built up into God's house. An interesting thing. We're living stones being built up in God's temple. But what's interesting to me about his statement there is that only people who have God at the center become living stones. And here's what people have to understand. That we were created, we were made for meaning. For meaning. And not just me, all right? We were made for meaning. And just look around you. I mean, I don't care. Look at how people try to have meaning in their life. They want to be part of something bigger than themselves, which they feel will give their life meaning. And there's nothing wrong with these things. I mean, I don't care if you join a football team, a basketball team, a baseball team, if you join a Rotary Club, if you're part of a woman's group. Just go down the line. All of these things, you become part of something bigger than yourself. I know that a lot of guys, and I'll speak from my own experience, you know, when I joined the Marine Corps during the Vietnam War, I really unconsciously or maybe even consciously wanted to be part of something bigger than myself. Unfortunately, I was just nothing but disillusioned with my experience, and it's a very, very sad thing that look at the suicide rate among the military personnel today. It's going through the stratosphere because I think a lot of these guys or women, they join the service, the military, wanting to be part of something bigger than themselves, only to find that, hey, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. But now here's the thing. We are living stones being built up into God's temple. Well, now we've become something, we've become part of something bigger than ourselves, but it has eternal meaning, eternal value. I mean, that's why I've been doing this for decade after decade, over 40 years. I don't know how many thousands of Bible studies I've taught over my lifetime, but I'm just a little stone. But I know that I'm part of something much bigger than myself that has eternal value. Because if we don't connect with that, then everything's vanity. Vanity of vanities. We're all going to be, we're all headed for the grave. And we're all going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground real quick. You know, and if God is not in the equation, and like I said, not as an afterthought, but as a prime thought, our prime mover, then everything we do in life is vanity. It's empty. It's futile. It's vain. It's void of purpose, right? And he goes on to say this, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge and pondered and searched out many and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write the words of truth correctly. The words of the wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails, and they are given by one shepherd. This word that we're reading, it's God's word, but it's supposed to act as a goad. What's a goad?
It's a prod.
It's a metal or an iron or a wooden, staff or stick or poker to prod dumb animals in a certain direction, right? And that's what God's word is supposed to do with us, right? And Solomon says here that he sought to find delightful words and write the words of truth correctly, and the words of a wise man are like goads. But here's the thing. He talks about them being like well-driven nails. You see, I don't know how many people I've run into. they almost feel like in order to say something, in order to say one word, they got to use 20 words to do it. God's word's not like that. It's like well-driven nails. Bam, 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 bam. If you really look at God's word, I mean, look at Solomon. You know, he said here that he searched out and arranged many proverbs, and he pondered how to say something in as few words as possible, because I always say, we need to weigh our words and not count our words. This is what we need to do. Weigh them out, man, and to use the right word in order to convey what it is they're trying to say. And then he says this, beyond this, my son, be warned, the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body, meaning what? It's a warning, God's warning. He's saying this, beyond this, my son, be warned, the writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. You know, Solomon may have thought, well, this is the information age. Look at all these books that are coming out. But I'm telling you what, we are living in the information age. I mean, we have to be really selective in what we read and what we watch on TV and what we listen to on the radio and what we really do, because there's so much out there. There's a vast ocean of stuff out there that's absolutely worthless. And look at how many of these kids today spend hours, 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 hours on a computer, on a cell phone, on all this social media. I mean, it is consuming their lives. But what is it doing to their social life? What is it doing to their bodies? What is it doing to the real connections in life? And then he says, in conclusion, what all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments. That's the thing. So I'm saying this. What it boils down to is this. We need to fear God, keep his commandments, because this applies to every person, for God will bring every act into judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Now, that's I spent a lot of time on that, but I really wanted to emphasize, you know, the fact that, okay, we're going to have to stand before God someday, where we are going to have to give an account of our life. You know, now God, like I said, he's very, very understanding, he's patient, he's merciful, he's kind, and he understands our frame and our fallen nature, and he understands all these things, and he makes allowances for it, and he's there to be merciful and forgiving. But I tell you what, we have to understand, we got to stand before him. And if we do fall, if we do sin, if we do offend him, if we get that right, then it's never going to be brought up. it's never going to be brought up in the judgment, but we have to be right with God when we die. That's what he's saying. But go back to Psalm 139, verse 5. You have enclosed me behind and before and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain it to it. When he says you have enclosed me behind and before, in other words, what is it referring to?
Well, he makes our way before us.
Yes, and he protects us, right? And David is saying, such knowledge is way over my head. I can't attain to it. And then in verse 7 it says, where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? I mean, he's asking a question here. And like I said, just look out there in the universe and just imagine how vast God's kingdom is. And, of course, hell. He says, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol or the grave or hell, behold, you are there. In other words, he says, if I ascend to heaven, look at these astronauts that have been up to the moon and been here, there, and God's there. He's up in space, right? And like I'm saying, all of hell itself is open before his eyes. And he says, and so is death. And he says in verse 9, he says, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. If you guys ever been on a plane and you've been flying at night, but then the dawn comes, it really is kind of an amazing thing how you can see this. And I've watched films that they film from space to show you the dawn breaking over the world. And it is really an awesome thing. But he says here, if I take the wings of the dawn and I dwell in the remotest parts of the sea. In other words, this world is traveling at 1,000 miles an hour. We're hurtling through space at 67,000 miles an hour. We're really moving, right? But, God is there. He's there. He's at the edge of the dawn. He fills this entire universe. And he says this in verse 10, even there your hand will lead me and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as day. Darkness and light are alike to you. He's talking about darkness, and you go back to when God created the universe. He said, let there be light, but then he separated the dark from the light. But, interesting thing, in Psalm 23, what does it say there in regards to death? It says that the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the path of righteousness for his name's sake. Now listen to this. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. In other words, through this darkness. Because the literal translation of the valley of deep darkness. That's death. Well, God's there. I'd stare at a person's death, right? I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And you go back over to what he's talking about as far as darkness. It says here that, it's the same to God. Light and darkness, all right? Now, just winding this down, he says this in verse 13. Now, just keep this in mind because it talks about, just God's all-knowingness and he's everywhere. He's omnipresent. But now, he brings it around to man. Now, man is made in his image and his likeness. What God is in an infinite way, we are in a very finite way. When we are made in his image and likeness, what does that entail?
It means we can communicate with him. We're made so that we can talk to him.
Yeah.
Because he has feelings. Yes, the Holy Spirit has feelings.
Right. Very good. Very good. In other words, God knows what it's like to feel love, joy, happiness, anger, hatred. I mean, we are made. Oh, look at all the gamut of the human emotions. God has made us in his image and likeness. I mean, what we experience on a very, very small scale, he does on an infinite scale. And the fact that there's a Trinity, there's a Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, in a sense, we too are Trinity in this regard. We are three separate components. We are our body, which houses our spirit, which houses our soul. So there's three distinct components to us, and I think that that's a reflection of the image of God. Because here's the thing. If I could separate myself and say, well, here's my body, here's my spirit, here's my soul, you couldn't say, well, that's John Hunt, and that's not John Hunt, or that's John Hunt, and that's not John Hunt. You see, the three are one, but they're very distinct. and just kind of in a clumsy way to keep this in mind. My body houses my spirit, and my spirit houses my soul. My soul is my very essence, all right? I'm three distinct personages.
And God created you.
Yes, yes, and we're created in His image and likeness, all right? So, he says in verse 13, "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were written all the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." Now, here's the thing. People have to understand this very clearly. When it says here, "You formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb." This is why abortion is such a horrible thing. In this country alone, it's pushing like 65 million abortions. It's just a genocide on the unborn. We have to really take a good hard look at what we're doing here and understand what we're dealing with here. And it says here, "For you formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb." Well, when we go in there and just terminate a child in a mother's womb, it's like snatching this child right out of the hands of God and just executing it. I don't care what these people say, but I want people to understand this clearly. Any woman that's had an abortion, it's not an unforgivable sin. But we have to owe up to this sin and confess it and forsake it, see? Otherwise, it's not going to be under the blood. But see, we just like to use semantics, and that's not going to get us over. We're not going to be able to stand before God and say, "Well, it was just a blob of protoplasm." Wait a minute. No, that's not going to work. Because he's saying here, "You formed my inward parts, you wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." I mean, you just look at the human body. Virtually every cell of the human body, has that DNA molecule, and that's all that's spiraling ladder that has the code of our entire genetic makeup and our body, all right? But interesting thing, that spiraling ladder is so tightly compacted that if we could actually take each, DNA molecule out of the body, out of our body, and stretch that spiraling ladder, stretch it out as far as it would go, and then stack it on top of each other, it would go from here to the sun and back. And the sun is 93 million miles away, right? It's just the connecting fibers of our brain alone. If you stretch them out, it could go around the moon and back. I mean, we are fearfully, wonderfully made. There's no question about it. And people, if they just feel like we just all evolved from snot, these people, have got a lot to account for. Because, just look at your eye. Well, you think it came out of a mud hole all by itself? I mean, there's no excuse for this. There's just absolutely no excuse. When he says, "I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." Well, when people don't give thanks to God, what happens to them? What does it tell us in Romans?
Turned over to all kinds of wickedness and lusts and...
Yeah, because he says here, "I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made." But the people who don't give God thanks and just say, it came out of the zoo. It says this, "For the wrath of God," this is in Romans chapter 1, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness." The truth is this, we were created in the image and likeness of God. He fashioned us, He formed us, all right? We didn't come out of a mud hole, but they suppressed that truth in unrighteousness, meaning what? Meaning they don't want to be accountable to this God, so they just say, "Hey, we just all came out of slop, soup, slime. We just all came out of a big bang out of nowhere. That way we don't have to be accountable to this God." And because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Meaning what?
It's in their heart.
We know instinctively there's a God. We just know it because He put this knowledge of Himself in our heart. He says, "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks." I was just talking about giving thanks, right? "But they became futile in their speculation, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures." In other words, evolution, right? "And therefore God gives them over to the lust of their hearts." And when we don't give thanks to God, he goes on to say in Romans chapter 1, He says, just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do the things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, full of envy, murder, strife, malice, and they are gossips and slanderers and haters of God, and insolent and arrogant and boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, in other words, hell, they not only do the same, but they also give hearty approval to those who practice them. See, this is what happens when we fail to give God thanks, right? He just gives us over to a depraved mind. And this is the end result, is all this wickedness that just perpetrates itself upon our society in every way. And so he says this, and my soul knows it very well. Well, I just read there in Romans where it says that God put this knowledge of himself in the heart. And it says, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. What does that mean?
Dust.
Very good. Because, why? Because, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. That's the earth. So when he's talking about, and he says here, skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, he's talking about the mother's womb, but this is dust. This is where we come from, is dust. You can say, well, I came from my mother's womb. Well, I guarantee you, when you drop dead someday, you're going to turn to dust. Right? Because you came from dust. You came from the earth. You came from your mother's womb. And she is but dust. You got it? See it? And he says in verse 16, your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in the book they were written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Now, what does that mean?
He hasn't learned a single day yet, but God's already planned out.
Yes, yes. And it says, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. In other words, he sees this child before it's totally created, or before it's created, right? And Jeremiah says, God said to Jeremiah, before I formed you in your mother's womb, I knew you. Right, so I'm telling you, that's why it's such a horrible thing when we snatch a human being out of the hands of God and just murder it and just discard it, throw it in the trash can, or cut it up for body parts. I mean, we got a lot to answer for, we really do. And he says, and the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. In other words, God has determined basically how many years, months, weeks, days, minutes, seconds that it's ordained for our life. But we can always cut those days short. How?
By breaking his commandments.
Foolishness.
In other words, if we are defying God and his moral laws, we can cut our life short. Go out there and join a gang. I was just talking about how a man needs meaning and not just meat. Well, even people, if they join a gang, it's because they want to be part of something bigger than themselves. But I tell you what, go out there and join a gang where they're all involved in violence and crime and murder and this, and see how your lifespan is going to be reduced. See? Just completely defy God and his moral laws, and you can reduce your life in this earth. But God goes again and again and again. God tells his people in the Old Testament, if you do what I say, if you obey me, you will very much increase the chances of prolonging your life in this world. See, even if you just lived a life of utter crime and you still lived to an old age, it's still wreaking havoc with your body. How?
Stress.
High blood pressure, you're always looking over your shoulder, this type of thing. I mean, we can reduce our lifespan, even if we don't get thrown in a slammer. How many guys end up getting thrown in jail, thrown in prison, and then they die prematurely? And, one of the ways, of course, is suicide. When a person takes their own life, they violate what's being said here. God ordained this many days. And so when you get in down that road as far as mercy killing, again, you can cut those days short. I'm going to wind this down because I know I'm over time. It says at verse 17, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I wake, I'm still with you. In other words, God's thoughts towards us are more than the sands of the sea. Sure. I mean, that's just vast. And sometimes we think, well, where's God in my life? Where is he in life? Well, he never stops thinking about us. And in verse 19, oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the uttermost hatred. They have become my enemies. Now, where's a critic going to find fault with this?
Hatred.
Yes, because they're going to say, well, we're not to hate anybody, which is true. We're not to hate anybody. But I tell you what, we are to hate Satan and the powers of darkness, all right? And we are to hate evil. But understand something. When Jesus Christ said this, he says, unless you hate your mother and your father and your brother and your sister and your wife and your children and even yourself, you cannot be my disciple. What did he mean by that?
Your love for God has to be so far.
Yes. In other words, our love for God must be supreme. When God said in Malachi, and he said in Genesis, that says, and Jacob I loved, and Esau I hated. Well, I know as a young Christian reading that, that didn't set well with me until I understood what it was saying. In other words, because Jacob had a heart for God, it was like God loved both Jacob and Esau. As a matter of fact, if you look at both their lives, you would think he loved Esau more than he did Jacob, the way he blessed Esau. But it's God said, Jacob I love, Esau I hated. Well, he didn't hate Esau. It's just that his love for Jacob was, you know, much greater than his love for Esau. And you can say, well, God doesn't have favors. Well, I beg to differ with you. I really do think he does. And his favoritism is not based upon, well, I like the way this guy looks. I like the way that she cooks. Whatever. No, no. God, what he's looking for is, does this person have a heart for me? That's what he looks for. If they have a heart for him, he doesn't care how much they may stumble along. If they continue to show that they have a heart for God, believe me, that's going to be his favorite. Just like Jacob. Jacob was a liar. He was a deceiver. He was a con man. He was this, that, and the other. But God dealt with him. But God could see, this man has a heart for me. Esau was just a blasphemer. He had no regard for spiritual things, right? He despised his birthright and this type of thing. Well, that when it's talking about hate those who hate you, it's talking about, you know, you hold them in low esteem. In other words, we're not to hate anybody. But I tell you what, I really, really get annoyed with these academic eggheads who are always, blaspheming God 24/7. I have no respect for them. And that's what it's talking about here. And he says, I hate them with the uttermost hatred. They have become my enemies. In other words, we have no common ground here. All right, we can't have fellowship together. There's no way. Because it's like night and day. And the last two verses, it says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. And see if there is any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Now, this is a prayer. First of all, he's saying, Lord, search me. You know my heart. You know my motives. You know everything about me. And what does Jeremiah say? He says that the heart is deceitful above all things, is desperately sick or wicked, and only God can know the true motives of the heart. I mean, have any of us ever seen a motive? Well, we may be able to detect a motive, but none of us have really seen one. But God can see it as clear as day. So he's saying, search me, God, and know my heart, and try me and know my anxious thoughts. In other words, it's an invitation to God to say, okay, Lord, I'm just a man with feet of clay, and just examine me. And he's saying this, and see if there's any hurtful way in me. In other words, if there's anything, any wrongdoing in my heart, any wrong motives or attitude, anything at all, he's saying this, lead me in the everlasting way. Meaning what? Meaning correct this in me. That's his prayer. Anybody have one to share?